Welcome back. If you aren't already following Naked, please take a minute to do so you don't miss out on any future episodes. Each follow means so much and it actually helps a lot. If you have more than just a minute, it would be absolutely incredible if you could leave a review and maybe even share an episode with a friend. I'm relatively new to the pod world, especially new to the things that are important in the podcasting world. And apparently reviews and follows are up there on the list of importance. So I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Welcome to Naked, where stories unfold. I'm your host, Janelle, a once former pastor's wife who exchanged small town living for a nomadic life. The unexpected change in our life led my husband and our four kids to traveling the world. From years of being rooted in our small town to the thrill of wandering the world, our story has been anything but ordinary. On our journeys, we've met amazing people, learned their way of life, and heard their unique stories, which has led me to understand the profound impact of shared experiences. In each episode, we explore moments of transformation, guided by one single question. Is there a time in your life when everything changed? We invite ordinary storytellers like yourself to share the often unexpected turns in life. So grab a seat and settle in. This is the Naked Podcast. A few months ago, my kids were playing volleyball on the beach in Italy, and a girl that was close to my daughter's age came up and asked if she could join them. And my guys are so friendly and outgoing. They're like, of course, come and join us. Come hang out with us. And before long, they were chatting with her dad and exchanging phone numbers and became friends, which led to us visiting them and joining them for dinner when we were in Barcelona. We had an incredible night where we connected the kids, connected once again like they did on the beach. And it was just an evening where we got to kind of know each other a little more of each other's background and stories, which led to, hey, Steve, would you like to be on the podcast? And of course, he's like, yes, I would love to share my story. I had no idea until we jumped on this call about his past and what he'd come through. And like I say often, one of the best parts of traveling is meeting incredible people. And Steve is one of those people. Him and his kids were one of our highlights while living in Barcelona. And I'm just delighted he's here today to share his story. Please note that there may be some triggers, such as alcoholism, drug abuse, and violence. His story is one of resilience, of courage, and of facing his fears and moving far beyond them. This is a beautiful, beautiful conversation where he tells all. I'm so glad that he's here, and I'm so glad you're also here to join us. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us at Naked and for another amazing guest. Like I've mentioned many times with traveling, we have the opportunity of meeting people from all over the world. And my guest today actually met my kids first. Greg and I were on a trip just traveling for a couple days. And when we got back, the kids like, oh my gosh, we met this amazing guy and his daughter. And like, when we go to Barcelona, we need to meet them and hang out. And I was like, oh my gosh, I got to meet this guy. And so when we got to Barcelona, we connected, and him and his children were so welcoming and had our giant family over for dinner and made us tacos. And we just had a really, really great evening. The kids kicked it off. And while we were there, I got to learn a little bit about his story, which, you know, I'm always intrigued to like learn more. There's so much we can learn from each other. And I was like, maybe I'll reach out to Steve and see if he would want to be on the podcast. So today is my guest is Steve. He has two amazing kids and lives in Barcelona. And I just feel like we just connected kind of off the hop, starting with our children and then having a beautiful dinner together. So today, Steve, maybe you can tell our guests a little bit about yourself, where you are, what you do.
Well, first of all, the beautiful dinner was Old El Paso tacos. Not to glamorize it. Of course, it all comes prepackaged, and all you got to do is cook it, add the little powder, chop up some lettuce and salad and put all the bowls on the table, and it's self-serve. So that is my chef story right there. And it was wonderful that you guys came over, and my two kids and your three out of four kids came over. And it was really wonderful watching them from a distance bond. And it was mm-hmm. really great. And the main story I want to talk about today is basically it's going to sound like an Alcoholics Anonymous advertisement. Although they are a nonprofit, the only money they expect is that you donate a quarter or a dollar or $5, depending on how much you got that day, when they pass the little cup around to help pay for the coffee and sometimes the space that these meetings are held in are rented. Many times they're in churches and there is no cost. And AA is an amazing program that saved my life, as well as Narcotics Anonymous, which are synonymous. They use a very similar book using the same 12 steps. And then I will mention that there are Overeaters Anonymous, there are Gambling Anonymous, there are so many different anonymouses that have to do with compulsive behavior that you can't stop. You feel like there is no rescuing you from these things that you know are not healthy for you. You swear you'll never do it again. And yet the insanity is that you do the same thing again, expecting the result to be different. And that's just one of many of the, forgive me, corny expressions from AA that saved my life. I'll quote one more, one day at a time. Because if we look at the challenges of trying to stop our addiction, we think about it as a long-term thing. Oh, this is impossible. I can't do this. Just think about right here, right now. Go 1 minute at a time without doing what you know is bad for you. And before you know it, it'll be 10 minutes and then an hour. Just think of right here, right now. Don't think about what happened yesterday. Don't think what's going to happen tomorrow. Just stay focused right here, right now. And then suddenly you will be saved. The founders of AA, one of them was Bill, and I forget the other gentleman's name, were two men in the 1930s who admitted they couldn't stop drinking. So they made a deal that they said, let's meet today and we'll stay together and we'll just stare at each other's eyes and talk. And they stayed up all night. And the next morning when the sun came up, they looked at each other and they said, we didn't drink. That was the beginning of AA.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's phenomenal.
1939, I think that was. By 1955, it had almost an international global attendance. And now it's, back then it was, when I first started, it was like, it doesn't want to be a public organization. That's why it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you could say at the beginning of each meeting, they go around the room and say, hi, my name is Steve and I'm an alcoholic. And you sit down and says, hi, my name is Jonathan and I'm an alcoholic. But that's all you know. And then you promise, you make an honest promise not to say anything outside the room that was said in the room. With that small introduction, I'd like to tell my little story that basically they say, tell a story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And my story starts, my mom and dad separated when I was 2. My mom was basically a single mom until she was 11 when she married my stepdad. He was a good man, World War II hero, retired colonel, retired pilot. He flew on D-Day, but he was very militaristic. Wow. He was very, very strict. He had 6 daughters when his first wife passed away. So he had to run a tight ship with the family, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And you can bet he wanted a boy because all 6 of his children were daughters. He had 6 daughters between the ages of 7 and 17 when his wife passed away. Then I come along some years later. I'm 11. I've only got my mom. And she wasn't very tight on rules. And I was pretty rebellious. So he and I, kind of like that. Once again,
clashed.
Honest man.
Yeah.
Integrity. But I didn't want any of the rules. So there was a little headbutting. Some might say a lot of headbutting at the time. But I will tell you that he was a good man. There was no abuse in my family. No one ever hit me. Nobody was a drunk in my house. My story is light. But in the late 60s, early 70s, growing up in Florida, there was a lot of drugs. And it was everywhere. And it was really cool. Big bales of, not hay, but bales of marijuana would float onto the beach. Because the big drug ships were offshore, would be being chased by the police, by the Coast Guard, and they dumped them. And sometimes they would float in months later. They'd be covered with barnacles and inside with marijuana. And I was just a kid, and we were all going, my God, look at this. And that is truthfully how I kind of got started. And it was easy. It was innocent. I remember sitting around in a circle with like 6 or 7 or 8 friends, and we'd be smoking the marijuana. And I would laugh so much, I would vomit. I was laughing, but I was laughing so hard, and it was so much fun. And that's the sinister, insidious part of drugs and alcohol. Because the first time you taste it, it feels good. You say, well, I like this. I want to do this again. For the next 18 years, it became my life. If I wasn't smoking marijuana, I was drinking alcohol. And then cocaine became a part of my story. Fortunately, I never injected any. I never liked getting near needles. I didn't do heroin. Mm-hmm. I forgot a little bit of LSD as well when it was popular. Mm-hmm. And when you're in adolescence, which kicks in about 11 or 12 years old, you think you know everything. I know. I remember Stanley, my stepfather, saying to me, Steve, I got 54 years experience in life. Do you think you know more than me? And the truth of the matter is, I have learned that I didn't listen to my parents, and my kids, my two beautiful children who are now 14 and 17, don't listen to me either. There is a block, a parental thing that the kids think that their parents aren't going to give them the best advice. I'll jump around a little bit. All my children's life, I have shared this story that I'm in process of telling you with them. If any one thing I want to be able to leave with my kids, I want to be able to tell them, don't drink alcohol. Don't smoke marijuana. Don't do cocaine. Why? Not because I'm your dad. Not because I'm telling you what to do. It's not like making your bed, brush your teeth, do your homework. I'm telling you because it almost killed me. I had two brushes with death in the course of my drug addiction. I have shared these stories with my children. Did it help, Janelle? I found half a bottle of vodka in my son's room about a year ago. He was 16. Then about 3 or 4 months after that, he had to be dragged home by two friends. It's the typical story right out of a movie. A person under each shoulder and the drunk being dragged by his feet to his room. And it's very hard when you know that my dad was an alcoholic, my real father, my brother, me, on my wife's side, her brother very definitely has drug problems. And you tell your son for as long as I can remember, since he was in diapers, I tried to teach him English, reading, writing, arithmetic. And here's my story about doing drugs and alcohol. And it didn't do anything. And I know he loves me. He listens to me. But there's something about that thing that the children have to go out and find out for themselves. Many people have to go out and find out for themselves. No matter how much... My story was, it just didn't work. And it was really, of course, the challenge is when you're around kids your age and it looks like everybody's doing it.
Totally. Yeah.
It looks like everybody's doing it. You know, I know that I was sitting in a circle, everybody's doing it. It's not true. Yeah. In my high school, there were distinct groups, right? There were the ones we called, back then we called them the jocks, because they were the ones, the athletes, you know, and they played all the sports and, you know, and then there were the nerds, okay, all those people who got straight A's and studied and, and then there were the cool people with long hair and smoked pot. Oh my God, which do you think I chose? Why? I don't know. That's the odd thing about that. In every environment, there are multiple choices we can make to mm-hmm. gravitate towards. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. I found the first two unappealing. And I was athletic, actually. I'm very athletic, still am. Mm. But I found this rock and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll is what we used to call it. For some reason, it just, that's what clicked with me. And it's a shame because
right.
from the time I was 13 to the time I was 31, my whole life is a blur. Hmm. I lost the most valuable years of my life with a preoccupation of before I left the house, I had to have my drugs in my pocket.
Right.
A cigarette smoker has to have a pack of cigarettes, right? I needed mm-hmm. whatever it was at the time. I needed that with me before I went out on a date, which is a whole nother story that I can tell if we don't run out of time. Yeah. Well, I think it's a good before.
I think,
what?
No, I was just going to say back to what you're saying about your son. I think sometimes we can, yeah, I remember being my 10, probably when it really started to hit me, it was probably 12 to 13, 14, where I kind of like you're talking about, you have this idea of how you see the world and you think it's so, your parents are just so old and your grandparents are even older, but there's this disconnection that they couldn't possibly understand because the world has changed so much, you know, in the timeline. But one thing I realized, and I heard this quote once, is someone said, don't be so worried that your kids won't do what you say. Be very aware that your children will do what you do. And I don't think that always, we see that always as quickly as we would like to, you know, as parents and as my parents. I think that it's like your story is a testimony, whether or not the kids can see it right now, a testimony to like who you are today and what you went through. He might not fully understand that. Just like, how can you explain to somebody what it's like to be a parent before they're a parent? You can't. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's no realm of understanding of what, how beautiful and how tiring and how amazing and how exhausting all of that is until you've lived it. And so he won't maybe fully understand. He can't fully understand in his 17-year-old mind and body what you went through and the struggles that you faced, just even knowing you've come from a father and a brother who all have struggled with similar addictions. But be very like knowing and aware in your heart that he will do what you do. Like it might not be right now, but he's watching you. And I think one thing I've realized as a parent is our kids have a front row seat to our lives. Mm-hmm. And sharing the struggles, I'm very much about sharing openly and honestly with my kids about the struggles that I've gone through and the struggles that we've gone through, and to not create those to be something that sits in the shadow in the darkness somewhere, mm-hmm. but to give it some room for light so that they know when they go through something, they're not alone. And that's why we're here. That's why you and I are here. Is naked is to be to shed light on things that oftentimes sit deep and dark within us, and to let people know that they're not alone, whether it's a parent today who's watching or listening to your story who has a child who's going through this, or whether it's someone who's struggling in addiction, whatever form it looks like. You said it could be food, it could be shopping, it could be alcohol, it could be drugs. Like to know that like you're not alone and that there's hope
Yeah.
in our stories.
Yeah.
You know?
I hope so. Yeah. I'm genuinely concerned about him because from my experience and the fact that it's not just one off, you know, the finding mm-hmm. of the vodka and then friends bringing him home. And there's at least one, two pattern. If there is a third example, and these are the two that you know, if you find him doing mm-hmm. one thing, that's the one out of 10 that they got away with, didn't get away with. So mm-hmm. I am generally concerned about Russell. And
totally. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I just have to wait and repeat myself. And most of all, I want him to know that if anything goes wrong, come home. That's one thing mm-hmm. I have to keep reminding myself to tell him is to come home. What I'd like to do is get back to a little bit to more of a couple of the war stories of my what it was like. When I was 17 years old, my first car, 1961 Rambler Ambassador. Bought it from the original owners in 1973. It was in perfect condition. And I had two brothers, not my brothers. They were brothers, Mike and Donnie Barker. Mike was in the front seat with me, and Donnie was in the back. We had a case of beer, 24 cans, put them in one big box, and they called it a case of beer. And I was driving my car over 100 miles an hour down this windy, stretchy road. And I took this curve that I'd driven many times, but way too fast. Because I was so drunk, I didn't know. I thought I was on the racetrack. And the car fishtailed around the corner. The right rear corner panel of the car, if this is the car and this is the right, had yellow and black paint on it. The front end of the car hit a fire hydrant. Water went 50 feet into the air. The black and yellow paint was from those telephone poles that had a big concrete embankment around it that was painted with diagonal yellow and black stripes. If I had hit that head on, I would not be here, and I would have taken two brothers with me. Hmm. And it was not by my doing. It was all by accident. So a good fortune of the fact that it turned just enough to barely miss the telephone embankment. Second brush with death. Jump forward 10 years. I'm selling drugs, a lot of drugs out of my house. And I wasn't home. I was at my girlfriend's house, and my girlfriend's phone rings. And my roommate says, "We've been robbed." Actually, this is what he did. "We've been robbed." They had hogtied him, hands behind his back, and the rope was around his neck, and Maury moved his hands. But he was able to dial the phone with his hands tied behind his back.
Wow.
It was April 1st. I said, "Okay, this is an April Fool's joke." And I said, "Well, if we got robbed, call the cops." And then I hung up the phone and said to my girlfriend, "I better go home. I somehow got some vibe." I get home, 20-minute drive or so. There's cops, two cop cars in my front yard. He did. He called 911. In the house, above the refrigerator, in a little drawer, there was 2 pounds of marijuana, scales, lots of money in the house. The house had been completely ransacked. And the thieves missed everything. And I'm sitting there for 3 hours, maintaining my composure. The cops aren't allowed to do any searching, opening drawers or anything, unless there's cause, probable cause. And they didn't have. All they had was a home invasion, as far as they're concerned. Even though they knew down here in their heart there was more to it than that, they didn't open up. So after 3 hours, they left. They didn't find my marijuana because they didn't look for it. They didn't find the thousands in cash. Neither did the thieves. Now, here's a real sad story. One of the thieves was a friend I had known since I was 11 years old. We were best buddies. But what happened is that he and this other guy had ounces of cocaine, and they had gone through all the cocaine. And now when you run out of something after you've been doing it for days, you become another monster. You become a beast. And they put a gun to my poor roommate's head and said, "Where's Steve? Where's the money? Where's the dope?" My poor roommate, he'd been living with me for 3 weeks.
Wow.
A loaded gun put to his head, which had been put to my head, and I don't know what would have happened. And he's very lucky to be alive today too. And those are just some of the nightmare stories that being involved with drugs, alcohol, you think you're in control of everything, and you're not. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely not. And I basically also want to say again that for 18 years, it's all I cared about. I managed to maintain a regular job, 40-hour-a-week job. And I was selling it to everybody in the company, too. And another memory just popped into my head. A vice president. And there was vice president of manufacturing, vice president of engineering. There are different vice presidents. One of the vice presidents walked up to me. He said, "How's it going, Steve?" I said, "Great." He said, "Just keep it at home."
Wow.
What? He knew.
Wow.
He knew.
Yeah.
Everybody knew. You think no one knows. You fool yourself and you con yourself into thinking about no one has any idea what's going on in your life.
Right.
Just keep it at home.
Right.
In other words, he says, stop selling it here at work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Word had gotten
bring it here.
Word had gotten to a vice president of the company. And this was a large corporate computer peripheral manufacturing company was then purchased by Siemens. So we're talking about a big corporation that I worked at for 12 years. And it was very, very fortunate. So one day at this same job, I missed work. I didn't go to work because I stayed up all night. I'd stayed up all night. I didn't do this often, but this one I did. So the next day, my boss says, "Steve, you put me in a corner. You didn't call in. And everybody knows what's going on. So I have a choice. Hmm. Either you go to a 30-day treatment center or you got to go to a psychiatrist, I forget which, once a week for 3 hours, basically to drive 1 hour, stay there an hour, come back an hour later, and it's paid. Which one do you think I chose?" I went to see the psychiatrist. Got to leave work, right. Go to work, leave work, come back and get paid the whole time. This whole 30-day treatment center. I mean, what do you mean? I got to stay in a hospital? No way.
Yeah.
So after 3 months, this doctor and I were battling wits. I had every justification in the world. Hey, I own 2 houses. So if this is mediocrity, I'm not doing too bad, huh? Finally, this doctor says, "You need to go to an AA meeting." Which he should have said, but he was making his money too. So, but he finally said.
Right.
So in order to continue with what my boss wanted me to do, I agreed. And for 2 years, I had to go to at least one a week.
Okay.
In order to meet the deal that I had with my boss and my corporation. And I never believed that I was like those people. I would walk into these rooms. I'll mention some extreme cases. People covered with tattoos. One guy had done 10 years in jail for armed robbery. Another guy was in a wheelchair because he was shot in the back while he was robbing his neighbor's house. Because he was a friend of the neighbor and he knew where the money was. And he was in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And then there were even some kids that are like 17, 18, 19 years old. And they were there because they'd already gone through a treatment center. And part of after you go to a treatment center, many times you have to continue treatment, quote unquote, by going to NA and AA meetings. So that's enough of the war stories. There are many more.
You're sitting with some people that have been through a lot in that space.
My story is light. My story is so, I didn't have to pay a heavy price to be here in front of you talking. There is another expression, everybody has to hit a bottom. What's a bottom? It means that you fall down once, 10 times, and you finally say, "I'm tired of ending up here. I'm sick. I am not doing well." Some people's bottom is getting shot in the back.
Yeah.
Some people's bottom is 10 years in jail. Some people's bottom is death. Everybody's got their own. There's no formula. There's no way someone can predict what your bottom is going to be. Mine was, I was fed up and I was so blessed. The same sister that gave me my first marijuana cigarette knocked on my door and said the same thing my mom had been saying to me. But once again, this gets back to, we don't We don't listen to our parents. We don't want to believe what they say is really, because they're not cool. My sister lived in a commune in Arizona for 2 years. She was a hippie. And 3 years earlier, she had gotten into a car accident while she was drinking. And she was in a semi-conscious state for about a week. And she came out of it. And ever since then, she stopped cold turkey. She says, Steve. And she knocked on my door, opened the door, and she says, you're on the same highway to hell that I was on. Those were her words.
Right.
And I have looked at treatment centers. I said, what? What? Yeah, I actually looked at some places where you stay for 28 days, et cetera, et cetera. And I was angry. My initial reaction was like, who the hell do you think you are?
Right.
Well, the next morning she came by, and these were not all nearby. They were some like 100 miles away. And when she knocked on the door, I went to my refrigerator and drank half a can of beer just to set them. I said, boy, this is it, man. This is it. I'm going to have, this is milk, by the way. And I slugged down half a beer. Let's go. And the amazing thing is that I actually got to sit in the car, and there was one I pulled up to, and it was behind a hospital, and it was in mobile trailers, like Airstreams. And there were like six of them, and this is where one was for the meetings, one was for sleeping, and I said, no, I'm not doing this. I forget the second one, but the third one was out in the middle of nowhere, just south of Orlando, in the middle of the forest. And even had to drive down this curvy trail. And you came out into this beautiful open area. There was a building there. And Janelle, one thing I remember, as we pulled into the parking space, I'm not religious, but something mystical happened. Suddenly I felt lightheaded. I felt as if I was lifted off the seat by an inch, and there was a cushion of air between me and the seat. And I think I expressed to you before, I felt like I'd been carrying all this wood for the fireplace, and I was able to set it down. And it was just an unbelievable moment where I said, this is it. I stayed there for 28 days. There were only doctor that was there was the one to take care of you if you caught a cold. Everybody else were counselors. Many were masters. I don't think there was any of them with a PhD. Masters in psychology. And the hospital, or whatever you want to call it, was a main building where they taught lunch and they did group meetings. And off from that main building, there were sidewalks that led off like spokes on a wheel to smaller buildings, which is where you slept. Two buildings, two of the sidewalks led to men's quarters. And it was like a small Holiday Inn. I stayed in a room with another guy I'd never met before. And then there was the women's quarters, where one sidewalk led to the women. A lot of nurses from hospitals who got addicted to the drugs in the hospitals. A lot, I'm talking about at least half were nurses. I was amazed. And then there was this one sidewalk that led to the youth part. These are kids that were under 18, some as young as 12.
Wow.
A lot of them a few of the people had been ordered to drug treatment center by a judge.
Okay.
They had done crime. They had done a crime or two, and this was like either you go to jail or you spend 28 days here. And I tell you what, if I would go back to that place, I would kiss those sidewalks. Because that was the beginning. And what's important is that they incorporated the AA and NA program. By that, I mean, there's a church nearby here where I live now.
Yeah.
And they have AA meetings two nights a week on Monday and Wednesday, I believe. And basically they open the doors. They let the meeting come in for free. Wow. And they open up a space. And one of the alcoholics shows up half an hour early and starts the coffee, takes out the brochures and puts them on the table and greets people as they come in. And that's a great thing to do if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic. You've got to fill the time. You've got to find, and doing service, they call it doing service. So what they're doing is feeling good about themselves because they're setting up the coffee and they're setting up the chairs and they're setting up the table and putting out the brochures. And they greet other alcoholics as they're coming in the door.
Right.
And that's a wonderful thing. And what this treatment center would do is that they would go to these churches and say, hey, you do two meetings a week here. And they would meet. And they say, would you add a third night and please come to our rehabilitation center? And sure enough, a bunch of these people that were drug addicts and alcoholics, they meet 2 weeks a night at a church. And the third night of the week, they go to this drug rehab center out in the middle of the woods out of the generosity of their heart to help others who are struggling with the same thing as them. So we would do these. We would watch movies. We would listen to speeches. And we would go to AA meetings. That's basically how I started. And NA meetings. And it was a wonderful 28 days. And it really was a wonderful thing to experience. And I spent 28 days there. I don't have the time to tell you about every day. Or had a journal.
Yeah.
It's the first time in my life I've ever kept a journal. At the end of each day, man, I was a crazy guy. Writing it. I don't know what I deal with it.
And you're 30. And you're 31 at this time in your life,
thank
right?
You, when thank you've you. Gone to the 31. Rehab. I was 31. I'm blessed to have gotten out of it at 31. Now, here's the thing about another thing about substance abuse is that they say that when you start replacing your emotions with mood altering substances such as alcohol or marijuana, because they change your mood, they make you feel different. And the first time I went out on a date with a girl when I was 31 and a half years old, I didn't know what to do. I had never done it this way. I didn't know what to experience. I was basically a 13-year-old in a 31-year-old man's body. My maturity level, my experience of trying to do things by just looking at the beautiful, I have a window here. I keep looking out my window here. I've never done that since I was 13. I didn't know how to enjoy the sound of a cricket or listen to my favorite Led Zeppelin song without being high. And now I'm doing all these things for the first time. And it is a scary, scary endeavor. It really, really is. I was so nervous the first 3 weeks. I remember the first time the phone rang and someone said, hey, Steve, can you give me anything? I said, let me call you back. I didn't call back. Thank goodness. I'm very fortunate. Only 25% to 40% of the people who go through drug rehabilitations never go back. Many people repeat and go back several times with no success. They're in and out for the rest of their lives. I am blessed that 37 years later, my worst vice is a cup of coffee. So I'm very, very fortunate in that. I'm here to tell you that it worked for me. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Actually, I think I did two a day sometimes, a lot of times. I would go because you have to fill the time. When I used to get high, time was filled, right? But now I don't have anything to do. What am I going to do, right? Besides my job, the worst danger I had was going home. It was the scariest moment. Okay, I'm here. What am I going to do? So let me jump back to in the 28 days in the treatment center, they had this wonderful exercise trail, a big circle of over the 5 acres, beautiful setting. And every 100 yards or so, there was a push-up area. Another 100 yards or so, there was a pull-up bar. Another 100 yards or so, you could jump over the horse railing. I used to love doing that one. And in between one of those exercises, I said, I'm going to do it. I remember the words. And by that, I meant I was going to quit my job, sell my house, and go into acting. I don't know where it came from. It was a divine thought that entered my brain from somewhere. I just thought, I had never wanted to be an actor before. Never wanted. So at 31 years old, you're supposed to wait a year. I did. I waited 1 year to the day. Hmm. And I went to my boss and said, I'm going to quit. But in the meantime, I started auditioning for community theater. Everybody knows a community theater. You don't get paid. They're done in these little behind a church sometime, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I did six plays in 9 months. That's insane. I drift one addiction for another. But at least this one is safe, right? And you rehearse a play 3 or 4 nights a week for like 4 or 5, 6 weeks. And then you perform it on 3 weekends. Yes, Pa. But in the meantime, while I was doing the performances, I go audition for another play. And there was one in where this is Melbourne, Cocoa Beach, Palm Bay. There was like 4 little community theaters that within reasonable driving distance of each other. And I was just hooked as can be. And I loved it. And then Universal Studios in Florida was opening up in Orlando in 1990. I auditioned. And this is where life gets so wonderful. I was an actor at Universal Studios, the theme park, for 5 years as a Ghostbuster. A stunt show in a 500-seat theater based on the movie. And maybe some of your listeners would, I remember him. My hair was dark back then. But I portrayed, by the end, they needed me to do 3 out of 4. I did every role except Winston because he's black. But the most part, I did a lot of these great parts. The next few years, I worked on cruise ships as an art auctioneer. I traveled the world. I have walked the Great Wall of China. I have ridden horseback next to the 3 great pyramids in Egypt.
Wow.
I have sailed the Baltic, which I couldn't even, someone says, where's the Baltic Sea? I wouldn't have been able to tell you. And now I can tell you I've been to Helsinki, Stockholm, Oslo, and St. Petersburg, each one at least 3 times because I worked on these cruise ships as an art auctioneer. We won't go into how in the world is art auctioning and cruise ships. That's not part of my story.
Yeah, I had no idea.
And I ended up in Los Angeles on a cruise ship, and I got off and I went into Rodeo Drive, Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. Walked into an art gallery because I just like walking into art galleries. I got hired on the spot. The guy wouldn't let me leave. I told him, I said, you know, I'm an art auctioneer, this sort of thing. I said, I like the Chagall, Picasso. And I knew everything. I knew all the lingo, I knew all the jargon. And I worked at Martin Lawrence Art Galleries on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. All these wonderful stories. And I got so many, we don't have the time. That since I have left substance abuse, I have had such a wonderful, wonderful life. The pink cloud, I used to say I'm like on a pink cloud. 16 years later, or how many, I'm sorry, 30, let me do the math. 37 years later, I'm a little bit used to the pink cloud, and that can be a trap too. You get so comfortable, you take it for granted, but I don't.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing. I can say that I don't. I'd like to give you a quick analogy. The first day I decided to quit drugs, I felt like I had been living inside this huge black building or like a warehouse with no walls in it. It was just pitch black. And all I knew was that it was enormous inside and empty. And the day I quit doing drugs, I noticed, however far away it is in this huge building, a door opened. And all this light flooded in to the door. But I wasn't near the door. I was in the middle of this huge black building. And every day I didn't use drugs, when I woke up the next morning, I was a little closer to the door, a little closer to the light. Day after day, I got closer and closer. Finally, I'm not going to put a time frame on it, but finally, I was at the door, and I actually felt the sun on my face. Mm. Went to bed that night. When I woke up the next morning, I was actually outside the building. I was actually one step away from the building, bathing in this beautiful, wonderful sunlight. Now, remember, all I have to do is turn around.
Right.
And I'd be right, I was right next to this huge building. And I look in the door, and there's the black. It's right there. Hmm. The next morning I woke up, I was two steps away from the building. It wasn't quite as imposing, but still it was a big, big building, and it was big and black inside. Right. Add up 37 years later, 365 times 37. Now I'm thousands of steps, thousands of days away. And I'm in this beautiful sunlight. I look over my shoulder. Now the building is just a small little speck on the horizon. Still there, always will be.
Yeah.
But this is the analogy that I have created in my mind that I have to relate to people trying to understand, well, does it get better? I tell you what, the building is barely, got it. Pretty soon I'll have to get binoculars to find it on the horizon.
Right.
But yes, it's wonderful. My life has been so, so full of things that I never imagined. As an actor, I will tell you, I've had the pleasure, not long roles, I did a lot of day players roles. I did some TV and film. I've had the pleasure of sharing the screen with Michael York, for those of you who know who he is. Dermot Mulroney, small part, but talking to them. Didn't work with him, but I actually had dinner with him and his family, John Lithgow. I gave his two kids at the time, I gave him each a Ghostbusters t-shirt. And he was as enthused as I was about having dinner with me.
Hmm.
So what I'd like to basically, I've shared with you how it was, what happened. Thank God my sister helped me. And one of the biggest challenges I've had is understanding I've got so much maturity and growth. Yes. Actually, I would say now 37 years, I'm about 50. I'm 68 years old, but right here, I'm about 50. Yeah. And it is good because I have this youthful energy that is mentioned to me many times. I go to the gym, I'm going to the gym today. I like doing these directed classes. That there's somebody yelling at you, jump higher, run faster type of thing. I really do enjoy it. And I'm going to basically tell the rest later. I think that I went over my notes. I have my notes right here. And I think I've gone over most of what I wanted to cover. And I just want to tell, hopefully, your audience will be able to relate to how easy it is to get involved, the beguiling manner that alcohol and drugs start with, and then they quickly turn into misery, death. And then finally, if you do decide to leave and just enjoy a beautiful sunshiny day for the what it is, nothing more, that your life will be wonderful. I promise.
Yeah. I feel like your story is such a beautiful arc of the seeing and hearing you go through the pain. A 13-year-old boy is just trying to figure out, you know, he's like won the golden ticket. Like, you're making money and you're finding all this stuff, drugs on the beach. And then this turns into an addiction that turns into a thing that can destruct you and destroy you, that could have ended in your life and your friends' lives. And like you said, it's like that period between 13 and 31, it's like, it sounds as though it was very numb. Like you weren't really present for those years in your life. But when you decided to make the change, when you decided to, in our talk the other day, you talked about it being a ritual, like actually preparing the drugs and everything. It was a ritual. And so when you left that and decided to change that, you had to find new things to put into those places where it was so like a ritual, like it was your routine, if you will. And it sounds like once you made the decisions to change that, life, like you said, has this pink glow in so many ways. It sounds like you've been given back so much of what you lost, like feeling the sun, you know, actually feeling the sun and seeing hope and stepping out into areas that you'd never even thought about, like acting. Maybe 20-year-old Steve would have been like, I want to be an actor, but that was numbed out and phased out by drugs and alcohol. But you found that, and then you didn't just like think about the idea. No, you leaped, you sold things, you leaped forward to this thing, to the unknown, you know, and yeah. That led you to so many beautiful and incredible opportunities that has brought you to where you are today. And I mean, it's such an inspiring story, hearing where you've been, to where you've come from, to all of the little in-between parts that were hard, but also the beautiful magic that happened. Yeah. Like feeling, sitting in the car and approaching, you know, that space where you're like, you just felt like such a something magic, something deep within you that was different than you had experienced with anything else that you had dabbled in. But this was new and you could feel the change, but then didn't just take it from there, but then step forward further and did the acts of service and then were people's heroes, really. I mean, you're like Ghostbusters, you know. And these kids, I'm sure many kids are just like in awe of you and of being, you know. I can remember the first time I took my kids to Disneyland and like they saw the different Disney characters, and to them, 3-year-old them was like, that's real life Anna, that's real life, you know, Cinderella, like these things that you just are so real.
Yes.
And you went through so many hard things, and yet you've seen so much light on the other end of that dark room, and you're like been able to exist in that light space for the last 37, 38 years.
Absolutely.
It's incredible, Steve.
Never would have imagined some of the things that I have done and been able to enjoy that I didn't think I deserved, didn't think were ever going to happen. And I'm just open to the opportunity. And very quickly, my daughter has been very fortunate as an actress, and we were in Italy on the beach, and she loves volleyball. She saw four kids, which happened to be your children, bouncing a volleyball around. She says, Dad, I'm going to go bounce my volleyball. I said, fine, I'm going to sit here. And I sat about 100 yards away for an hour. And finally, she calls me over, which she never does when she's hanging out with kids. And one thing led to another, and then your children fascinated me that they're there in Italy on the beach. Mom and Dad were at a music festival, I think, in England. I forget what it was. And they were so cool. And I said, and then suddenly came, we're going to be in Barcelona. I said, well, let's hook up. And this is the other thing. And we'll save the rest for part two. I never imagined having guests over for dinner, me cooking guests for dinner. You know, this is one of the part of the beautiful journey, and the journey has been so wonderful. And another corny expression is, not about the destination, it's about the journey. Don't live for the destiny. The journey, which is right here, right now, is why we live. It's all we have. These moments we have between us. I'm having a great time right now. Talking to you, bathed in sunlight, wonderful, wonderful experience. Got my gym appointment at 7:30 tonight. I'm happy.
You're living the life.
Yeah, you bet.
If you were to speak to somebody directly about something you wish that maybe a person in 20-year-old Steve could know, you wish he would have known, or say a parent listening, you wish that they would know about their younger child, would there be something you would want to leave with them?
I believe that for a parent-child relationship, and I don't always follow my own advice, no matter how much they push you back, you always have to go back. If they push you away, you are the only one on the planet that will lay down in the street and let the vehicle hit you before it'll hit them. And it's an amazing thing. My mom once said to me, she says, if I ever found the person that gave you some drugs, my mom was a gentle Costa Rican lady, and she had the look of fury. If I ever saw the person that gave you drugs, I would kill him. And I saw the look of, I think she meant it. Mm-hmm. And that is the most beautiful thing that we parents have to accept about our protection of our children, about what we believe will hurt them. And we can't let that go. I don't know if this is related to, I'm not saying it'll help them not do drugs, but if they constantly disappoint you, you have to remember all these friends, all these acquaintances they know, will never lay down in the street and let the car hit them before they let it run over your daughter. They'll just throw her under the bus or him under the bus. You are the only one they have. And we can never forget that. If they're 14, my son's now going to be 18 soon. It's an absolute must. And I'm saying this to myself to remind Steve, because my daughter's at that age where she's not very receptive to anything I say. I've done this to you before. This is what I get whenever I tell my daughter to do something. I have to remember. Outside the house, people tell me she's a jewel. They tell me your daughter is so mature for her age. She is just involved in conversation. And from a distance, I've observed it. Unfortunately, with her dad, my wife passed away, and we'll share this. I'll share more of this in part two. Her dad and she basically, I take care of food, clothing, and shelter. But other than that, I'm not very well received to be involved much more than that. And we have to accept that, Steve. You have to accept that. And still ask, is everything okay? Can I do anything for you? Here comes a kiss. I'm going to give it. And she's like, here comes on the forehead. I'm going to give you a kiss on the forehead. Okay, quickly. That sort of thing. So, of course, my son, he's different. Russell's very affectionate. Russell's very huggy, kissy. We hold hands walking on the street. He's 18. And I hold hands. Well, I mean, he's going to be 18 in December. And he and I hold hands walking down the street. I like it. Alejandra wouldn't dare. We're getting a little bit off the track, but the beautiful thing too is I'm doing all this sober. I'm doing all this, and I'm experiencing the emotions, the ups and the downs, without trying to seek some sort of solace in some liquid or some powder or some pill. And what happens is that tomorrow, my growth, my my emotional growth will be a little bit higher than it is today, because I don't try to deaden the feeling with alcohol or cover the feeling up with a marijuana cigarette. Mm-hmm. I let my body, my mind, and my soul process even these moments that aren't pleasant with my children, what I consider not pleasant. And I wake up tomorrow morning, and sometimes I take a big deep breath and I go, okay, let's go. But you have to do it today. And I sleep so well at night. Well, I got my little aches and pains, but I sleep. There's nothing worse than waking up in the middle of the night because there's something inside you that's eating at you. That's not good.
Yeah.
I mean, I got my little, my back aches and things like that. That's a different thing altogether. But no, this is a wonderful journey that I'm on. And I'm very happy to experience it. And I'm looking forward to waking up tomorrow and experiencing more.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here and for sharing.
Thank you for asking me, Janelle. I share this story personally, one-on-one with people. And I hope some of your audience will be able to make comments and say, you hit my life on the button. And so they won't feel alone.
Right. And that's why we're here.
Yeah. Wonderful.
And that's why it's so important that you're here to share that, because there are people that are lost in their own journey and they're not sure there is hope. And I think hearing stories like this reminds people that there is light beyond that dark room.
Absolutely.
Like you so
we have
beautifully.
All you got to do is do it. The only person stopping you is you. And you're, and you are also you are also the person that's going to be your success. And there's a tremendous pride in that. A little bit of ego going on here. You know, like saying I met Michael York. I'll tell you a quick story and then we'll end. We'll end, okay? I'm going to tell you a quick story.
Okay.
The TV show was called Sequest. It was a popular science fiction show from the 90s. And I had the part of a newspaper reporter. And it was Michael York, Michael Ironside, and my acting coach, Michael Costello, in a scene. And I was in the background. I'm a reporter. I ask a question. I ask another question. And then the director says, and cut. And I was so impressed with these three Michaels. They had done a wonderful job because they're arguing between them. And it was, you say something, I say something. And it was so well done. And me and my big mouth, I said, that was great. Right after, I mean, there's like 20 other extras, and two of the guys had asked questions, so I was an actor among extras. And the director said, cut, and I'm standing there 3 feet away from Michael York, Michael Ironside, and Michael Costello, and I said, that was great. And Michael York looked right at me, we are so glad you approve. And that's part of my wonderful journey.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Oh, as we cap off here, tell me if there's something in your life right now that's bringing you a lot of joy.
My going to the gym brings me a lot of joy. I am blessed to say that my life right now, I'm basically retired. And my wife passed away a year and a half ago. And I would love to share that story in our next podcast. We'll call this part one and we'll do that part two. And I'm enjoying taking care of my children, making sure that I'm there for them, tell them to call me all the time. I'm blessed that I don't have to work every day. I don't have to go to a job Monday through Friday for 9 or 10 hours a day. I find that the best thing that makes me most happy is to keep moving. And to be contrary. What makes me sad is when I stay stagnant, when I don't. I was looking forward to this meeting this morning with you because it's even though I've been sitting here, I've been moving the whole time. To me, it is like moving. It gives me purpose. And I think that's very important for all of us, is to have a sense of purpose. This whole thing about being retired and doing crossword puzzles is not for me. You know, the whole thing is I enjoy exercise. I say I'm retired. Last month I went to Brussels. I do corporate events as a master of ceremonies. On the average, about once every 2 months, I do a gig. And they pay very well. Pay very well. Towards the end of last year, in October, in November, and in December, I got slammed. I was gone 3 weeks out of four during those. It's amazing. I was like, and since then, 2024, it's been dead. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure why. But I have a couple of clients that like to use me every 6 months. I do also sales training. These are sales people, and I basically give them inspiration and motivation. It's not really about the five steps of a sale. In presentation, discovery, overcoming objections, and finally closing. That was four out of five. I forget what number five is. But it's a more of an emotional type of thing. When people want to buy with you, from you, it's because they feel a connection with you.
Connection.
Emotionally. Yeah. So I try to impose that. And I get that. I do that about once every 6 months. So I have these things that bring me joy. They really do. Do I need the money? No. Do I demand a lot of money when I do it? Yes, because I want the respect. And I've been very fortunate that these companies appreciate the my experience. But none of them, none of them know this other side. You wouldn't ever imagine. And that's the other thing. I never looked the type either. I always had short hair, owned a house, had a job.
Right.
But yet I was the guy that your mom warned you about. I was not the type of person you would like to invite into your home. I was definitely like the wolf in sheep's clothing.
Because you masked it really well.
Because I would immediately, hey, everybody, want a party? I've got the stuff. You can buy some if you want to. And it was that way for a good solid 10 years. Of the 18, the latter 10 years, was I was very fortunate not to get put in jail. Lightning struck all around me. Lightning struck all around me. Three of my friends were killed during the course of those 18 years due to Florida was like a cowboy. It was like the Wild Wild West during the 70s and 80s. Wild Wild West. It was crazy. Everybody had a gun. And I'm very fortunate not to have been, not used one or have one used on me. But that's
right.
I detracted. Well, my most beautiful thing is that I get to wake up every morning and I'm going, okay, what have I got going on? I got a nice calendar. I should have brought my calendar. I'm the old fashioned. I have a big open calendar, a monthly calendar. It's a book.
Perfect.
Opens like that. And I've got all 31 days right there. And I have to look at it every morning to make sure I know what I'm doing today. This morning it said, Zoom on Chrome.
Share my story.
Yes, absolutely.
Aww. Well, I am delighted that you came and shared your story. Thanks. And yeah, and I feel like some people will find inspiration through their own journeys just hearing where you've come through. So huge gratitude to you for joining the Naked community and being here today. I hope that you have a beautiful day and that you get to go and enjoy your workout today. And as you wake tomorrow, like you said, you're just learning and just growing. And tomorrow there'll be more roots that you've established today that you stand with more knowledge tomorrow.
Perfect.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Take care. And I look forward to next time.
You bet. You bet.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcast goodness. This way you'll never miss out on any future episodes. Plus, it really helps us. And if you want to share your favorite episode with a friend, that would be absolutely incredible. This goes a long way. If you'd like to join Naked by sharing part of your story, just leave us a message on Instagram or email us at nakedwithjanelle@gmail.com. Also, a big thanks to my son, Mikkel, who is the best cheerleader and maybe one of the biggest believers in Naked, and also produces and edits all our podcasts. I am beyond grateful for him and very aware that I couldn't do this on my own. Thank you so much for tuning in and for being here.